The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Happy holidays. This is The Takeaway for Friday, December 23rd, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It's irresistible, you know. Americans seeking to find themselves on TV and the blooper reels, American Idol. Getting on TV for 15 minutes was the old Andy Warhol expression of the new American dream of celebrity. But there's always been this question. Who gets to be on TV? Who do we see on that screen?
Wally, I wish when you misuse one of my tools, you'd put it back where it came from.
But I found it in the kitchen. It was in with the knives.
Just where you left it, Ward.
You know, I've asked Lamont for a long time now to get me cable TV. See, cable TV would clear that picture up.
Well, why won't he get it for you?
Because he's a cheap son of a... Hello, Lamont.
Keep you off the pills. I'm good.
Good. That's good to hear. And you can give them to me then.
Give you what?
Give me what? The pills, boy. Don't act stupid.
Junior is a Republican.
No, it can't be a Republican! Oh, Jesus!
How in America did we go from the Cleaver's Kitchen to Sanford's Junkyard and beyond to Empire, Blackish, and Underground? After 2 years of the protest hashtag OscarsSoWhite, this year seems to boast an array of diversity in television and film. Several of Hollywood's biggest holiday releases, like August Wilson's Fences and Margot Lee Shetterly's Hidden Figures, star well-known African-American actors. And lesser-known actors are becoming household names in movies like Moonlight and in TV series like Luke Cage, Queen Sugar, and Atlanta. This hour, we'll explore the parallel evolution, racial justice in front of and behind the big and little screens. We'll hear from the people who changed the world, as well as some enterprising voices from a new generation of actors and filmmakers. We'll hear from Leslie Uggams, Norman Lear, and Julie Dash. Scott Heath starts us off. He's a cultural theorist and professor of English at Georgia State University. You'll hear him throughout the program as he helps to underscore how important Black America's emergence on television has been, the successes and the mistakes.
Thinking about shows like Sanford and Son, Good Times, The Jeffersons, you have shows that are often attempting to address very serious issues, but in a comedic format. There was some subtlety, I'd argue, in some of that comedy, which is to say there was a subtle approach to some of our understandings of our relationships as Americans at that time. In order to get the humor, you had to sort of understand the politic around it and be able to laugh about that, at least for a quick moment.
That's interesting.
Well, if you weren't to some degree sophisticated, you could be to a great degree offended, I think, by some of that humor. You had to understand that the actors and writers were trying to be funny about it, that they were being lighthearted about it while asking you to think more critically at the same time.
How would you contrast the view of America that you see in Roots with the kinds of treatments of the Underground Railroad that we're seeing in popular culture, in books, and on television?
In so many ways, a lot of what we see in cinema in terms of slavery cinema is represents a sort of remake of Roots or a talk back to Roots. It's hard to watch 12 Years a Slave or Django Unchained without an awareness of Roots as a sort of
a source
launching point.
Yeah,
of a source, and maybe a point of critique. If anything, I think that the you know, people had various feelings about Django Unchained, but it represented a sort of aggressive approach to the notion of freedom making as connected to an Underground Railroad. The WGN show Underground obviously is about the Underground Railroad, yeah. And sort of approaches the institution of slavery with the more, again, aggressive approach toward freedom making. Another controversial film, The Birth of a Nation, I think was in its rendition of the Nat Turner history, was also sort of aggressive in its approach to the consideration of freedom making. So maybe what we have in one sense is a move beyond Roots that suggests a bigger agency, just a quicker pace toward emancipation, toward abolition.
We've passed the point where it's about getting it right or getting it down as historically accurate, and we've moved to a more artistic approach where we're more fluent in understanding of the history and therefore take more liberties with the emotions.
I don't know. I don't know if we're more fluent in this, in the specifics of the histories. I think that we're definitely more aware, maybe not more fluent, but more fluid because, you know, we're seeing some different approaches, and there are people who, you know, and I believe this is one of the problems with reception, you know, when you have something like Django or The Birth of a Nation, thinking about what happened in Nat Turner's history and with Nat Turner's rebellion, I think there's still an urge toward or yearning for something documentary, such that when we have the poetic license of a Django Unchained, people say, wait a minute, that's ridiculous. You know, that's not how things were. Even, you know, in the sort of heroism of Nat Turner, we have people saying, wait a minute, that's not how it was. That's not what Nat Turner said or what he would have done. So there's still this, again, an urge toward the documentary that I think might coincide with something that's happening right now in screen culture, broadly speaking. And the screen culture I'm especially speaking of is one that is demonstrating for us all too frequently the treatment of black bodies by the state or bodies sponsored by the state. So many deaths at the hands of state-sponsored entities, and these we're seeing this via the documents that people are making with their cell phones, and you know, a type of document that began around 1990, 1991 with
Rodney King's
beating.
Rodney King,
right?
So you would see an unbroken line between the, you know, sitcoms of the 1970s and the cell phone videos of Ferguson and Cleveland, in that they come from a similar kind of yearning to know what's happening, to get beyond the curtain.
I wouldn't say the line's unbroken, but there's definitely a line, an intersection. I believe that our desire, both as spectators and as people who live these lives that are being represented, our desires may be changing, or at least becoming more nuanced. I think our idea of humor is becoming even more nuanced than it was in the sophisticated 70s. I'm thinking of shows like Atlanta that has some funny moments, but it's not a program that I call a comedy per se. It's actually a very serious document on some level of life in the Atlanta metro area at a particular time in history. Something I'm interested in with these shows, and I think that connects them right now, is a real attention to soundscaping.
Uh-huh.
We're trying to figure out appropriate modes of protest. And you have these shows that have these wonderful soundtracks, great music. And I think it's no coincidence that a lot of the people behind the cameras or who are directing or who are directing photography have experience in music videos.
Right.
In other words, people whose jobs have been to connect the sound and the image. But about this voicing, you know, I Can't Breathe, Black Lives Matter, you know, these things that sound like slogans are also attempts at sounding blackness at a particular moment and sounding a particular experience. And I think that's actually, whether it's deliberate or not, sometimes among all these recent programs and films, I feel a searching of voice, a searching of expressive mode happening, and I think to good result.
Scott Heath, cultural theorist and professor of English at Georgia State University, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And now you can call her a Fellini from Harlem. Julie Dash is a movie nut, has been ever since she was a kid when she decided to be a famous director. Her 1991 film, Daughters of the Dust, was the first movie directed by an African-American woman to receive a theatrical release in the U.S., and the only film to date by a black woman that has been added to the National Film Registry. Dash was one of a group of young black filmmakers whose work was influenced in part by the Civil Rights Movement, the riots in Watts, and the Vietnam War. The films and stories of her generation are a piece of history that Dash and her friends were always convinced they were a part of by making and consuming TV and film.
I was an avid reader of Toni Morrison, Tony K. Bambara, Alice Walker, Gloria Naylor, and I wanted to tell stories about the lives of complex women at pivotal moments in their lives, just like they did in the written form, in the novel. And so I was bursting at the seams to get on with that, you know, right after Daughters of the Dust.
What were the obstacles in Hollywood and in entertainment? Why so clubby?
That's a great word, clubby, yes. I believe they see themselves as the curators of culture. They want you to tell the stories that they want you to tell, that they want to see, that they want to hear about, more about. And if you present something different, they like, you know, like, thank you for submitting. Thank you for your time. Adios.
What in pop culture excited you about the changes that were afoot in terms of more diverse faces and stories getting on the air and on screen?
Nothing that I could think of. When I was growing up, I didn't think about the media because we just weren't there. I couldn't see a present. I remember one night my mother waking us up to see a movie because there was a black person in the crowd, and that was Andy Griffin film, A Face in the Crowd. There was a black family on camera. She woke us up. She ran in the bedroom and woke us up, and we all jumped up and ran out to look at the television because there was a black family on the screen. I'll never forget that.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
How important, as you've watched this transformation in Hollywood, do you think it is for the healing and the development and maybe the maturing of American culture?
I think film is the perfect medium. Film and television, the perfect medium for healing, for expanding, the expansion of knowledge, the expansion of ideas and hope. That's why it's so exciting to know that there's Netflix, Amazon.com, all of these other new forms of streaming video. And so it's new forms of streaming ideas and streaming new cultures that you've yet to visit.
And so many African-American producers and directors have taken advantage of this golden age. I mean, this is a crazy time for opportunities, it seems.
It's a crazy time, but there's still gender issues.
How would you describe them? How would you describe them?
There are hurdles and minefields that you have to get through to still get a film greenlit, even if it's through one of these new video-on-demand agencies that or production companies. It's still extremely difficult because those particular production companies are going to the same agencies and pulling from that same pool of directors and producers and cinematographers that Hollywood is pulling from. So we still have to, you know, bang on a lot of doors.
What would you say is the most hopeful sign or positive sign of the changes that we've witnessed really over the last 50 years
The most Hollywood. Positive sign?
Yeah.
That one's easy. Ava DuVernay, Queen Sugar. In 6 months' time, Ava DuVernay has done more to advance women filmmakers than Hollywood has done in 100 years. She hired women directors to direct the entire series. Black women, white women, Asian women. 6 months, changed the landscape. It's phenomenal. There's been nothing like this that ever happened before.
That's director Julie Dash. Her 1991 film, Daughters of the Dust, has been restored and re-released to celebrate the 25th anniversary of its original release. It was a young Norman Lear who found a rich new source of stories, just as the Leave It to Beaver era seemed to be ending in the 1960s. He found a white, intolerant, know-it-all breadwinner in the working-class family depicted in All in the Family, Archie Bunker. Lear opened a window on Black America through the nastiness of Archie Bunker and the growing group of characters who dared to confront people like him.
Yeah, I figured I could do a lot for the people in this district.
Which people are you talking about?
Look, I know what you're thinking, Bunker, but I'm talking about all the people. Blacks, browns, yellows, and whites.
How come you put the whites last?
From Lear's early television shows like All in the Family, he was able to introduce a new candor and eventually African-American characters to a wider American audience. Sanford and Son, The Jeffersons, and Good Times, starring Esther Rolle as Florida Evans, a role she also played in Maude.
When Esther Rolle was playing Florida on Maude's maid, we could see she was a star. And to determine whether there was a series in it, we introduced her husband on a couple of episodes of Maude, John Amos, And when we had the John Amos in Florida together, it was, the network was saying, hey, there's a show there. So, of course, we knew we had the first African-American family on television. And that was exciting because it hadn't happened before, but ordinary in the sense that we were dealing with yet another family of a different skin color.
When you began the revolution in television that started with All in the Family, what did you think you were doing that would change American culture?
I didn't think I was doing anything. When I brought writers into a writing staff, I said, let's pay attention to our kids and our mates and our what was going on in the family. Let's all read a couple of newspapers a day. And we'll pick the subjects for the episode to episode based on what is current and by way of problems and difficulties that we faced, because I learned the hard way there was comedy in difficulty. And as a matter of fact, that's how, you get sparks by rubbing the sticks together. You don't get it by keeping them apart. We brought those problems into work, and we were dealing with what we were living as families.
When did you realize that All in the Family was a part of the weekly conversation in America among the middle class and the lower middle class? When did you realize that was going on?
When I read about it, or when journalists asked me about it. I was, we were all people seeking to make a living. I have six kids. I was growing a family and working my ass off to make a living. That's really, truly what I thought I was doing. I was excited about doing real life problems, dealing with real life problems with real life, if we were getting it right, real life characters. That's what we thought we were doing. We began to understand when we would read and be asked the questions by others that we were having some influence that we didn't set out with any expectation to get.
What do you think of the real acceleration of African-American characters and dramas and the extent to which the Underground Railroad, the cable revolution, the digital revolution has propelled African-American history onto the screen, way beyond the work that you did, but in many ways started by the first steps that you took back with All in the Family?
Well, I love it. I mean, and I am so flattered when I hear Kenya Barris talk about his show Blackish as following stuff that we were doing some years ago, or Carmichael. I think those shows are sensational.
What do you think of Hamilton and the dramas that have been launched by so much of this history that Americans never really talked about?
Well, I've only seen Hamilton four times so far.
Oh God!
And I could see it a couple of nights a week. It's that enthralling and wonderful to me.
I mean, I saw Hamilton. I thought to myself, this is really the way in which art takes history, takes what's happening right now, and makes it electrifying. And I mean, I think that's what you've been doing all of your career. And it really gives you hope about America, because there is such fascinating history for all of the pain and agony in this country. Do you feel a part of that Hamilton revolution when you look at that show and others like it?
The fact that I've been in the business, that I've hired actors, that I know about acting, that I know anything about it, is very secondary. I just plop into a chair and my attitude is, take me. Whatever the show I'm watching, you've got me, take me. And Hamilton has taken me to the moon.
Does America understand its history, and that its history in many ways puts blacks and whites on a trajectory of inequality unless we decide to really confront it?
I don't think so, because we don't have leadership. We don't think enough of civics to make sure our kids our learning. We don't think as much as we used to of the arts and music and such. Those things that bring us together. The arts bring us together. Laughter brings us together. We share in common our citizenship. The fact that that Shonda Rhimes is a celebrity doesn't mean she isn't a citizen. And I've always admired, going back to the Gregory Pecks and Burt Lancasters and Paul Newmans of my life, I've admired those stars who have worked hard to share, to mix their celebrity with their citizenship and stand up for the things they believed in.
Norman Lear, thanks so much.
I couldn't have enjoyed it more. Thank you.
Legendary producer, director, and writer, the 94-year-old Norman Lear. Well, we're moving on up, we're moving on up to the east side. The timidly bold humor of the Jeffersons on TV is matched by the radical experimenters who, at the other end of the entertainment spectrum, push to disturb and provoke audiences. Jennifer Nikki Kidwell and Scott Shepard are the co-creators and performers in The Underground Railroad Game, a comedic risk with a thought-provoking and at times uncomfortable theatrical performance.
We place ourselves in an Underground Railroad situation in order to introduce this game, but the piece doesn't take place necessarily along the Underground Railroad. But if we were to use the Underground Railroad, the myth of the Underground Railroad as a metaphor, then we start getting to things that we're looking at in the piece. And that's this myth of the white savior, the black body in distress, and the simplicity with which we want to tell these stories.
Yeah, I would say it's more about the American imagination, the cultural imagination, is a feeding ground for all sorts of kinds of lies. And we take from truths and we add to them and we romanticize them so that we come up with these versions that can kind of mollify our anxiety about the truths that are staring us right in the face if we didn't have some way to hide from them.
You structure this piece around a relationship. On some level, you go from relationships that were hidden to relationships that were forbidden to relationships that are completely normal. And there's somehow a line from one to the other, yet we don't know how we got here.
We kind of push into the darkest possible territories as we explore this particular relationship, kind of to see if there's anything left.
Can there be a love story?
That's
in
right.
The midst of all of this pain and torture and degradation.
But, you know, we put ourselves back on the auction blocks. We are looking at nude bodies. We are...
And language.
Yeah, we're
like how we actually signify our bodies. Like, one thing that the piece tries to do as well is understand that just as much as a slave's position on an auction block creates a sign, the relationship of the white person to the auction block also creates a sign. And that's a situation and a system out of which that person can't step.
What was it like?
In the way that he and I, like these two people, are competing with each other, I think there's a latent competition that runs throughout the piece. And so there are moments in that scene where my character is in charge, but then I think by the end, that's really up in the air.
In that scene, what's really interesting is that I'm kind of on a race towards selflessness, right? Like I'm trying to become the purest, most heightened version of the white savior by putting myself into this revenge fantasy, by allowing it to happen. So there's this funny way in which we're both playing out a really perverse fantasy, and then we both kind of have to stand back and look at that fantasy and say, did that really get us anywhere? Once the game kind of breaks and they both of the characters step away from it and look at each other, that's the longest silence in the piece. And if there's any kind of healing or understanding or humbling, that's where the reconciliation is happening.
Do you feel like you've overstepped?
I think every night I have a moment where I'm like, did we go too far with this?
I mean, that's a huge part of the piece. That's a question we ask ourselves inside the piece. As people who have kind of, if there's any moment where we kind of unmask.
How far can we go?
How far can we go? And is it right to go that far?
Yeah.
Jennifer and Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Nikki Kidwell and Scott Shepard are the co-creators and performers in the theatrical presentation, The Underground Railroad Game.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. We're going to take a few moments and talk about the current moment in entertainment history. The African American Film Critics Association is actually pretty excited about this year's awards season. It will not, they say, be another year of the protest hashtag #OscarsSoWhite. Gil Robertson is co-founder and president of the African American Film Critics Association.
This year we've seen a treasure trove of content about the Black experience, the African-American experience. And so it's cause to celebrate.
What is the impulse, do you think, to focus on that African-American experience in certain kinds of movies? We've seen The Underground Railroad get a magical realist treatment by Colson Whitehead, but also a relatively realistic treatment in the cable show that looks at the Underground Railroad, a very popular mythological element of America's historical racial legacy, bad and good.
Well, you know, like most things in this country, it comes down to business. And with the entertainment, you know, market share, Hollywood's portion of that, you know, shrinking in terms of the number of people who are going to cinema, the number of people who are watching television programming, the powers that be simply have felt a need to slightly shift gears and to create content that address diverse audiences. And so I think that certainly has a lot to do with it.
When you founded the African-American Film Critics Association, did you ever imagine you'd be predicting the end of hashtags as a gauge of whether the Academy has got their act together or not? I'm referring, of course, to Oscars So White.
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, when we started the organization in 2003, it was just simply to address some of the issues that myself, along with some of the founding members, felt were pertinent to Black journalists who were looking to begin careers as film critics. And over the years, it's evolved to include advocacy on behalf of a number of different issues related to the entertainment and cinematic arts.
On some level, do you maybe quietly dread this season coming around every year because you're going to be asked questions that maybe you do have answers for or you don't, or you wish you didn't have to get asked these questions, that sort of thing?
You know, that's just something that is expected of us. You know, like, for instance, we issued a statement calling the end of Oscars So White, and one of the things that prompted us to issue that release was, you know, people are often so attracted to negative news and, you know, the finger pointing and, oh, what you're not doing right. And so as an organization, we thought, you know what, Hollywood's done a great job this year of making the effort. And so, you know, let's acknowledge that, too. You know, you want to point out both the good and the bad.
Favorite movie this year?
Personally, I thought Lion was excellent. I thought Dev Patel really did capture that character. It's about a story of a young boy who gets lost in India and is subsequently adopted by an Australian couple. Hidden Figures is another true gem. It's the story of a group of African-American women, although it spotlights three of them in particular and their participation in the development of the space program. And Moonlight. I mean, Moonlight is, it's so rare to see a film that captures the identity of Black men, and the effort that this film made in that direction was superlative.
What do you think accounts for the diversity in movies and the extent to which America right now seems to be very interested in its own history?
Well, maybe it's because we've come to a certain age in our development where, you know, we recognize that the past is important, and we recognize that the past can very often be an indicator of what our future is going to be. And, you know, we have a pretty interesting history in this country. I mean, you know, all of the various populations that inhabit America, I mean, there are tons of stories that have yet to be told.
Gil Robertson is co-founder and president of the African American Film Critics Association. He spoke to us from Los Angeles. Gil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Exxon and Mobil, offering synergy gasoline engineered in Exxon Mobil's Formula One fuel lab. Exxon and Mobil, energy lives here.
For Americans of a certain generation, a turning point in television history, the first moment when African Americans got to see themselves on the screen in an epic story from slavery to liberation, came with the broadcast of a TV miniseries in 1977 called Roots on ABC.
Papa wants to get back to masses. Don't want to run into any patrollers after it gets dark.
Kizzy, don't you want to be my slave? Aren't you my friend?
Of course I'm your friend, Missy Ann. I just has to ask my mama and my papa.
That's Leslie Uggams as Kizzy Reynolds in Roots and Sandy Duncan playing Missy Ann Reynolds. Uggams has one of those faces, beauty and familiarity. She had her own TV variety show back in 1970. A performer since the age of six, she's been a cultural pioneer, winning a Tony Award for her Broadway debut in Hallelujah Baby. Today, Uggams remains popular for her roles in big projects, including the hip-hop television drama Empire and this year's hit comic book movie Deadpool. Uggams spoke with Takeaway producer Dana Roberson about how it all started with Roots, which pushed Americans to challenge the myths of a dark past that had been swept aside, but today can't be hidden.
Well, it was the first time that America got exposed for their history. Everything had been hush-hush because it certainly wasn't in the history books. And Alex Haley wrote this incredible book about searching his roots and this journey from Africa to America and how we were treated. And people were just riveted because they had never seen anything like this before. And that's why every night people were glued to the television. And that's why it got such huge ratings, because people were, like, shocked.
Yeah, I don't think anyone did anything else but watch that series.
Well, also, remember, there was only three networks, so therefore we didn't have to compete with cable. And you better watch it if you wanted to see it. And, I mean, it was like the stars were aligned. There was a big blizzard in the east, so people were kind of shut in. So everything worked for the show, and including the head of ABC, who decided he didn't think much of it, and so he wanted to get rid of it, and he put it on every night, which made him a hero because it became the miniseries, and he got all the credit for that. But it was just a special experience.
What was it like personally playing the role of Kizzy?
Well, Kizzy, I carry her still in my heart, because she, through terrible, terrible circumstances, still managed to keep her head above water and to bring up the son and make sure that he carried the tradition that she had gotten from her father, which was keep telling the stories about where you came from, pass it on, pass it on, pass it on. And she was an extraordinary, strong character to play.
Does our generation sort of have that desire or knowledge that it's important to pass information on, do you think? The younger generation today.
Well, you got the iPod and the iPad and the I this and the I that. I mean, information has become sound bites, unfortunately. I don't know how many sit down with their parents or their grandparents and really ask them about their history. They should. When I was growing up, I didn't get much information from my grandmother because they were ashamed of, you know, being born slaves and living on plantations, and it was a kind of horror story, so they didn't want to share that. But I think it's very important now for parents who, you know, you have children, to tell your stories.
Was your grandmother still living when Roots came out?
No, unfortunately, she had passed away, because I know she would have loved it. She would have loved it, because she was one of 10 children, and her mother had children by the plantation owner, but he built a house for them and a school on the property. It was it's quite an amazing story, the Boyds. And they were well educated, and they became dentists and doctors and teachers, and it's amazing.
They have come out recently with a recent updated Roots. Opinions varied on whether it stood the test of time. I think the original Roots stands the test of time. But there's been a lot of sort of a resurgence of these sort of slave narrative movies, series that have been coming out. Do you think it's important that we continue to tell slave narratives, or should we move past those times?
Well, I think we need to start talking about the modern times. I mean, there's been great people in our history who have made great contributions, and you know, we've seen the slavery situation, and I think it's time to move on and do something new, because we certainly have great people in history that we could make movies about, and that's what we need to do. It's not easy, you know. It's kind of, I guess, easier when you see black people in conflict and that, you know, that kind of thing. Oh, that makes a great movie. But I think it's time to move on.
Speaking of moving on, Deadpool.
Yes, that was me.
Blind Al, what was that like?
Oh, awesome. Just absolutely awesome. I had such a great time. I love Ryan Reynolds and Tim Miller, who directed it. And I just love the character. She's feisty, and they have a great relationship. It's kind of like a love-hate relationship. And they're both together, funny as hell.
It's great to mix it up, too.
Yes.
You know, challenge yourself.
Absolutely.
In different roles and comedy and serious roles. And it's certainly a far cry from Kizzy.
Oh, yes.
And Empire.
Yes. I love that character and Leah Walker. And people have really taken to her. She's scary. She's cuckoo, cuckoo. So you never know what she's going to do. But people really have. They're enjoying her tremendously. And I love the fact that it also gives the character of Lucius, you really understand where he's coming from. Because even though he's been flashback with his rapping, telling his story and everything, to see the dynamic now between him and his mother right there in the flesh, who was supposed to be dead.
But she wasn't.
But she wasn't.
And now she's there.
Yes. It makes it his character even more powerful, I think.
So what's next? What's next for you?
I never know. Quite honestly, I never know. You know, my mother used to say to me, you look around one corner and it comes around the other. So I'm looking, and who knows?
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
An honor. Thank you.
Bye.
That was Takeaway producer Dana Roberson in conversation with the legendary Leslie Adams. We conclude this hour with a discussion of a piece of American cultural history, something that was nearly lost in this country's delusions about its past. The subject in the 1980s was inequality and injustice in Louisiana. The film had a first-time director in Horace Jenkins and an all-African-American cast. The feature film Cane River from the 1980s had a premiere and then dropped out of sight for decades. But 2 years ago, a negative of the film Cane River resurfaced. And now the archival restoration group Indie Collect is in the early stages of restoring a film that was ahead of its time with a singular point of view. Horace Jenkins' son Sasha was just 11 at the time of his father's death and has never seen a completed version of the film. He's a writer and filmmaker himself, and today he says going back to Cane River is both liberating and a burden.
At that time, the early to mid 70s, you know, right before my father was doing his film, you had this strong era of black exploitation films that were highly successful. And apparently the overall standard white mainstream film industry was hurting, and the black exploitation film era ushered in a lot of money and kind of saved the film industry. And once the film industry realized, well, black people will go see The Exorcist, they figured that they didn't need to invest in these black films. So by the time my dad was focusing on his own films, you know, my father was primarily a documentary filmmaker. So the films that he worked on were about saying something. Even in this era, in 2016, it's hard to get money for films that are saying things no matter what color you are. And when my dad was doing his thing, it was extremely difficult.
What do you know about Cane River?
Well, it's a region in New Orleans, primarily occupied by folks who are of the quote-unquote Creole persuasion, i.e. black folks who are mixed maybe with some French heritage, with some Haitian heritage. And this region has been this way for hundreds of years. And my father found it interesting wherein, you know, he made films in Africa. He did a lot of things about the African-American experience. And I can only imagine that this time capsule that is Cane River was fascinating to him, particularly for issues of class and color amongst black folks.
And he found a financier for this film, which in many ways might have been the most valuable thing he did for black filmmakers, to connect with this benefactor. Tell me that story.
Well, what's great about that is the family who financed the film, the Rhodes family, they're a prominent black family in New Orleans. They've been doing dignified burials for African Americans since right after the Civil War. They were a successful black family who believed in the vision of, you know, what my father was looking to put up there on the screen. And it was, I don't want to say it was luck, but they were very ahead of the curve in terms of any family, but a black family with money investing in something that was completely foreign to them on the business side.
What are your impressions of your dad's struggles and really the kind of culture he was in, both in and out of the commercial area and the places that he dreamed of finding audiences as a filmmaker?
Well, I think you have to look at the time where he lived. You're dealing with civil rights, racism, the CIA. My dad was all over the world. He was in the Middle East. He was in Africa. He was in all these places where black men at the time didn't travel, looking to do these stories that were connecting the black experience in America to the global experience or the African experience. The struggles that he dealt with weren't just societal or financial. They were emotional. They were physical. You know, we deal with so many issues today. Every day I'm seeing an African American being murdered by the police. It's easy to say it's worse now than it's ever been, but I wasn't around then. I can't imagine the restrictions that my father had to deal with, not only as an artist or as a businessman, but as a black man.
What did he convey to you or leave behind that gives you a sense of what it must have been like for him to go to Addis Ababa, to Ethiopia?
You know, my mom is from Haiti, and she's a painter. And my father was a documentary filmmaker and a filmmaker, and he was a storyteller. So what they've both left for me was the sense of looking at myself, but also looking at things that go beyond money, things that go beyond status. I was taught to appreciate culture and see culture in all aspects of life.
What do you think the story of Cane River is, the place that Cane River has in this narrative of Birth of a Nation, that it's an answer to a much more controversial film that describes in wretched distortion the African-American experience? How do you fit into all of that?
I think it's a part of the larger narrative of making up for years and years and generations of propaganda and bad storytelling. I think that with all that's going on right now, there's an interest in these films, or at least there's interest from Hollywood in getting behind in spending money. Now, I'm not saying that Hollywood doesn't have a heart. I'm not saying Hollywood doesn't have an interest in making change, but Hollywood has an interest in making change, as in making money. So all of this stuff is topical right now, and there's a wave. Will the wave continue? I don't know. I hope it does. But I think right now, all of these black films that are coming from perspectives that we haven't heard are just making up for a lot of lost time. And I think the problem is African-American, black filmmakers, folks of color aren't considered Americans, because if we were considered Americans, all of America would be extremely outraged by the way Americans of a certain color are being treated by the system or being treated by police departments around the country.
What's your wildest dream for Cane River? A restoration, a remake of Cane River with you at the directorial helm, or the making of Cane River, your discovery of what this film's all about?
Well, for me, the priority is to get my dad's vision out there in a way that it was never acknowledged. You know, me growing up in Queens with a single mom, I always told folks that my dad was a filmmaker, and it kind of went in one ear and out the other. Now, it's a great feeling to know that finally me and my dad can work on something together.
Sasha, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Sasha Jenkins is a writer and filmmaker and the son of filmmaker Horace Jenkins. And here's a final thought today from Professor Heath. With all our talk about African-American images on American television, we have avoided the most famous and most controversial of all African-American entertainment, Bill Cosby, whose body of work is now inextricably linked with the women victims who have accused him of rape and sexual assault. What are we to make of Bill Cosby?
Bill Cosby's had such a long career of various interests and various politics. You know, the Cosby that we discussed as a sort of person chastising African-American youth and hip-hop, right, and all of that. You know, it was also the Cosby who was helping to finance, you know, Melvin Van Peebles when he was doing Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, and the Cosby who I can only imagine put money into other places that we're not publicly aware of. The Cosby who invented the Fat Albert Gang, you know, which was a kid's show on one hand, but also a really sort of socially conscious prescription and critique for how to live and about blackness in particular. I mean, we've seen him in many forms and formats, right? The many permutations of Bill Cosby. So I think that's why it's difficult to approach Cosby in the moment of, one, this discussion of black lives and livelihood, and also a keener discussion of gender, sexuality. Much of America, and definitely much of black America, saw Bill Cosby constantly, right, in one form or another. So it's hard to disassociate if that's what one is trying to do.
Professor Scott Heath leaving us with something to think about and reminding us of the power of images in entertainment and history. We'd love to know what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great holiday. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.